Today's episode of Vital Voices is brought to you by Oak Tree Medical Center.
Welcome to Vital Voices, the podcast where we explore the people, the passion, and the purpose driving better health for all. I'm your host, Alexis Burrows. Today's episode takes us to the front lines of life-saving medicine with a powerful conversation on what happens when seconds count and why planning ahead can make all the difference. We're joined today by Dr. Jazreel Thompson, anesthesiologist and critical care intensivist at Doctors Hospital. From high-stakes decisions in the ICU to the quiet strength found in assigned directive, we're unpacking how critical care teams work under pressure and how advanced care planning helps patients, families, and doctors honor life and dignity in the most challenging moments. So whether you're a caregiver, a healthcare professional, or simply someone who wants to be more prepared, this episode is for you. Welcome to the show, Dr. Thompson.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
We're recording this episode for May, which is Critical Care Awareness Month. So we thought it would be helpful to have you come on and kind of talk a little bit to our audience about, how critical care works, things like advanced directives, to provide some education and information to arm people to know how to better manage and navigate these things. You started out as an anesthesiologist. What drew you specifically into the critical care element of medicine?
Critical care was always a goal. Mm-hmm. Initially, when I graduated from medical school, I originally thought my passion for medicine lied in primary care. Mm-hmm. And I started off in a family medicine program at the Princess Margaret Hospital. One of the first rotations of that program I did was in the intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. And that was actually my first exposure to that environment. And I was just overwhelmed, inspired, amazed. I had one patient who had a peptic ulcer that had perforated and had required emergency surgery, was in the ICU, and was successfully treated. And at that same time, a family friend was in another country with a peptic ulcer that perforated and died.
Oh, wow.
And in that moment, it made me realize how important critical care can be, mm-hmm, to stepping in an acute life-threatening illness and either turning it around or not. Mm-hmm. So critical care combines my love for critical thinking, analysis, procedures, interventions, and like you say, being at that front edge of, mm-hmm, really making a difference in, mm-hmm, a patient's life.
Yeah, it's interesting. Critical care is one of those, it feels like you have to be able to think on your feet very quickly and process a lot of information at once to make the best decisions in the shortest amount of time, because you're talking about life and death.
Right.
In almost every instance. What does the ICU life look like? What is a typical day for you in that space of working in critical care? What does that look like for you?
A typical day would be coming in, taking a handover from the night team, getting updates about what happened with patients overnight, mm-hmm, assessing new patients, reviewing lots of information in the patient's chart, such as their laboratory results, their vital signs, speaking to my nursing staff as, mm-hmm, well, any concerns or issues. And then together in conjunction with, it's very much a multidisciplinary specialty. You combine and collaborate with other physicians and other specialties such as cardiology, mm-hmm, neurology, nephrology. And together we come up with a plan, and with the nurses, we work together to provide comprehensive care, mm-hmm, for a patient.
Okay.
That's a typical day.
Right.
And then you have the chaos, mm-hmm, which is patient's not okay, mm-hmm, vital signs are irregular or not good, and you're having to intervene, mm-hmm, like you say, very quickly.
For listeners who may not be familiar, because I know even when I moved into working in marketing in the hospital, there were elements of, healthcare that I wasn't firmly aware of or familiar with to that extent, right? So I know even for me, critical care was something where understanding kind of what it was a bit of a learning curve, right? So for our listeners who may similarly not be familiar, what exactly is critical care and how is it different from, say, emergency medicine or general hospital care?
Okay. So critical care, basically everyone's familiar with the term ICU.
Mm-hmm.
ICU is the intensive care unit. It's the highest level of care a patient, mm-hmm, can receive in hospital. So let's start with the emergency room. The emergency room is usually the first line, a point of care for a patient who presents to the hospital either on their own means or through an ambulance.
Mm-hmm.
The emergency room is treating an emergency. I like to think about it in terms of 3 hours, 3 days, and 3 months.
Okay.
And you walk into the emergency room, and there are things that we can do because you could either be in cardiac arrest, which means that your heart has stopped, mm-hmm. so we need to perform CPR. You may need to be intubated emergently. Mm-hmm. You may be in a trauma or an accident. You may be bleeding out, and it's things that we do to stop an actively dying patient, mm-hmm. basically. It's also the front line where we can start investigations after doing history and physical and try to decide exactly what's going on with this patient and what mm-hmm. they need. Now, a lot of patients go to the ER, are not discharged. They're found not to have anything that's life-threatening, that's not emergent, or it's in a level where you need some further medical care. Mm-hmm. Usually come back to the ICU if you have any end organ dysfunction.
Okay.
That could be you had a stroke, you have mm-hmm. an altered mental status, you've had a heart attack, you're in a DKA, which is an emergency related to diabetes. Mm-hmm. If you need to have continuous intervention or continuous monitoring, certain medications that require very specialized management, mm-hmm. you'll be admitted to the ICU. So in our ICU, your nursing ratio, who are champions of our ICU unit, you're going to be monitored very closely. That means that one nurse is taking care of one patient or two patients, mm-hmm. which is different from the medical floor where nurses are able to manage more patients, up to 4 to 6 patients at a time, because those patients do not have the intense needs as a patient in ICU. So again, certain medications that we need to administer to stabilize you, mm-hmm. in terms of if your blood pressure was too elevated and you needed a constant infusion, mm-hmm. like I said, if you had a diabetic crisis and you needed an insulin infusion, you'd come to us. Mm-hmm. If there was any acute injury to your kidneys and you needed to be started on dialysis, that would be another reason to be admitted to the ICU.
Okay.
And then we have the monitoring that takes place in the ICU. So you're constantly going to be monitored with your heart rate, your blood pressure, your oxygen levels. Mm-hmm. That does not happen in different other areas of the hospital. Vital signs are monitored less frequently.
Okay. Fair enough. I mean, from what I remember of it, it's like it's life-sustaining care, basically. If you're not getting this care right in this moment, you have a greater risk of not making it out, right?
Correct.
So yeah, that's kind of what I got from it. So what types of patients typically end up in the ICU? I know you mentioned, you're talking about end organ dysfunction, things like that. Like if you get in a car accident, is that something where you land in the ICU, or does that depend? Because I know that may be like the emergency room, but how do you go from, okay, I'm just here in the emergency room, or I've been on the ward for a day or two. What are some of the changes that may happen that lead people into stepping up from one of those other areas into ICU?
So I would talk about the ABCs of medicine, which is where we talk about resuscitation. If you have any challenge to your airway, any breathing difficulties, mm-hmm. you're not able to do that comfortably on your own, if your oxygen levels are declining, if your blood pressure is either too low or too high, and if there's any changes in your heart rate or rhythm, those mm-hmm. are like the main. Those are like some of the common things that will land you into the ICU. You can end up in a car accident. You might have a minor injury. Mm-hmm. You know, you could be monitored just to make sure there's no progression or new development injuries. But, you know, some of our traumas can include shark bites mm-hmm. or amputations mm-hmm. or blunt trauma that causes mm-hmm. internal bleeding. Those are different types of scenarios. Mm-hmm. Other cases that we commonly see in the ICU, it's interesting. I started off in primary care, and I'm treating primary care illnesses in ICU.
Oh.
Hypertension. Mm-hmm. I always told my patients in primary care, high blood pressure is something that you never feel until it's too late. Mm-hmm. So when your head starts hurting and you have a headache and you bleed into your brain, you're going to be in the ICU. If you mm-hmm. have a stroke and you're unable to move, you know, half of your body, you can't swallow properly. Mm-hmm. You know, same thing with diabetes. If you're not managing your diabetes too well and mm-hmm. you end up in a crisis, you'll end up in the ICU. Other two things that are very common so coming to the ICU is an infection, sepsis. Mm-hmm. Overwhelming infection that then affects your ability to maintain your blood pressure. You end up in a state of shock. You require antibiotics and medications to support your blood pressure. Mm-hmm. Those are some of the common things. But there's many other conditions that can lead you, make you acquire an ICU admission.
One of the things people may hear about, you know, a lot of people, you watch a lot of different like medical shows, you have your Grey's Anatomy and House and things like this that have been on TV over the years. And people might be familiar with hearing things like, you know, a rapid response team or a code team. What role do they play? Because again, you're talking about split-second decisions sometimes, life-changing, life-altering decisions. What role do those teams play in, you know, this space of critical care and in the ICU?
So, good question. So, the rapid response team or the CO team, let me just distinguish them. The CO team responds to an actual cardiac arrest.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, if a nurse walks into the room and the patient is unresponsive, she checks for a pulse, there's no pulse, there's no mm-hmm. signs of breathing, she's going to call a code, and that's going to alert all of the necessary personnel to come and respond with airway equipment, mm-hmm. with medications, a defibrillator to try and resuscitate that patient. The rapid response team is almost like a pre-code team. The American Heart Association, when they developed the cardiac arrest guidelines, mm-hmm. we developed something called the early warning signs. So after studying cardiac arrests and things that led up to the cardiac arrest, mm-hmm. there was a pattern, and it was noted that there are certain red flags that can take place mm-hmm. before the actual cardiac arrest happens. So the nurses are empowered to call a rapid response if they feel, oh, this patient is not actively coding, like they've not lost their pulse or their mm-hmm. stop and stop breathing as yet, but I've noticed that their heart rate has gone down, their blood pressure has gone down. Mm-hmm. I want them to be seen and assessed to see if we can intervene to prevent a cardiac arrest from occurring.
Okay.
Now, if that's not successful, you know, the moment a patient does go into cardiac arrest, they will likely be transferred to the ICU
mm-hmm.
because it's probably likely they're going to need to be intubated. Mm-hmm. They're going to need to get some support on the ventilator. They're going to need to be started on medications, like I said, to support their blood pressure.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we've had a lot of different conversations over time about, you know, this concept of multidisciplinary teams and care that's involved in healthcare. And no matter which angle you're looking at it from, there's always this need and for different types of expertise, different types of focal points. So it just is interesting. Even in the ICU, you have kind of this split between, you know, your ICU team, the rapid response team, the CO team, and how all of those
kind of
work together to ensure best possible outcomes. You know, kind of looking at it from a different vantage point, you know, I imagine healthcare in general, like I always tell my wife, because my wife is a physician, I always tell my wife, I don't think I could have been in like a physician in the healthcare space because I feel like the demands of it from the emotional standpoint, like I feel like people, I can't see that. I don't think I could see that every day and be like a normal human being, right? And I feel like physicians in some ways, you're either built for that or you grow into learning how to navigate that space. But you know, in your experience, what are like the emotional and mental demands placed on ICU doctors and nurses? Because I imagine it's a very stressful job.
It is. Nothing can prepare you for the day that you're going to lose your loved one. And we know dying is a part of life.
Mm-hmm.
No one books an appointment in the ICU. Usually when patients are coming to the ICU, it's the worst day of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the worst day in their family member's life.
Right.
Given the complexity of that and those situations, we know that it can be very stressful for all of the caregivers involved
mm-hmm.
in the ICU. I must say, though, I'm very proud of the people I work with, the people I've trained with, the people I meet in the ICU. I believe there's a commitment to compassion. It requires a lot of empathy. And it's very important that we are treating patients who are dying in a dignified and respectful manner,
mm-hmm.
that we're mindful of the pain that their loved one is going through, that they're going through. And so it does require people who definitely are human people who mm-hmm. actually have a passion for providing care and compassion.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Yeah, I've learned from talking to different people in the healthcare space over the years that, you know, sometimes from the outside looking in, you would take the impression that, well, all doctors should be people. But then you realize there's certain specialties and areas where you kind of don't necessarily have to be a people person and you can get away with it. But it definitely seems like you're talking about it, you know, when you're looking at this is quite possibly the worst day of this person's life, their family members, that's a lot to navigate. And then you as the physician are balancing the interaction with the family in trying to keep them informed, but also keeping track of the patient and making sure that they're getting the best care possible. So
like I said, I don't envy that, because I imagine it's quite a tall task to take on.
Yeah. I always am mindful that I'm managing two types of patients in the ICU, mm-hmm. the actual patient who's admitted mm-hmm. and the family member. I'm managing their shock, I'm managing their anger, their fear, mm-hmm. their frustration. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it is my job to help to provide as much information right. and understanding of the process and to be there to support them so that they can support their loved one mm-hmm. as best as they can.
Is when you think about it, you know, when you're faced with, is my loved one going to make it out? Everything is more tense. So the wait time feels longer. The time in between updates feels longer. Everything feels...
It's magnified.
Yeah, it's magnified to an intense degree. Before we move on, I imagine you've encountered your fair share of interesting and memorable, for lack of a better word, interactions with either patients or patient families over the years. Can you share a powerful story or moment from the ICU that's kind of stuck with you as you progress through your career?
I can, and this has actually happened more than 10 years ago when I was mm-hmm. in residency. I was rotating through a surgical trauma ICU. Mm-hmm. I had a patient who was 85 years old, came in with a hip fracture from a fall from home, underwent surgery, was in the ICU, but due to her comorbid conditions pre-hospital, mm-hmm. She was not doing well. Her postoperative course was very complicated. Mm-hmm. She had a history of COPD, cardiac disease, and we were actually unable to wean her from the ventilator.
Oh, wow.
And so we were preparing to have a family meeting mm-hmm. because we wanted to advise the family that, you know, we didn't think that she was going to recover mm-hmm. and we did not think that she was going to be able to wean or extubate her from the ventilator.
Right.
And usually we try to, you know, always give patients the benefit of the doubt, give them everything, give them the full fighting chance. But then we see every patient is different and mm-hmm. everyone progresses differently. And I remember this conversation was about the code status, whether we should make this patient DNR, mm-hmm. which means that do not resuscitate in the event of a cardiac arrest,
right.
as opposed to keeping her as a full code, which we thought would be the best thing, because a code would not be successful, mm-hmm. it would be traumatic, mm-hmm. and it might not be the most peaceful way for her to expire. At the meeting was her grandson with his wife, who was her next of kin. Mm-hmm. And after explaining everything to him, you know, his words to us were, "I love her enough to let her go."
Mm-hmm.
And I was just struck by how selfless mm-hmm. he was. He mm-hmm. was in tears. He was visibly upset. But at the end of the day, he said, "I actually want her to be comfortable and at peace."
Mm-hmm.
And I admire him for being so brave. Most mm-hmm. people would generally feel the opposite way.
Mm-hmm.
But it did strike me that, you know, with proper, you know, good information, understanding, I wish many patients, many more family members would be able to be comfortable mm-hmm. in saying that.
So it is it's difficult, because I think for a lot of people it's hard to kind of know what the right decision is there.
Right. And we'll talk about how we'll talk about decisions. Let's talk about decisions.
So that's where we'll move to next, right? So can you explain the concept of the advanced directive, what it is, why it matters? And then especially in critical care settings, why does it matter?
Absolutely. So an advanced directive, the term refers to a document
mm-hmm.
whereby a person has said, in the case of an emergency when I cannot make a decision for myself,
mm-hmm.
I would like this person to make a decision for me.
Right.
That is usually accompanied by, and that's known as a healthcare proxy
mm-hmm.
or a durable power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually accompanied by a living will, right?
Mm-hmm.
That would then stipulate, or we have more details to mm-hmm. say, I do not want to be intubated.
Mm-hmm.
I do not want to have cardiac arrest. I do not want to undergo dialysis if it's a new
mm-hmm.
condition. Or I do not want to have this surgery or that surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So I must say that in the Bahamas, that is not a common thing that mm-hmm. we see, because there is no technically legal framework for that to exist.
Oh, really?
Right. So plot twist.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I also wanted to make sure you understand the context, right? I trained in England for my medical school. Mm-hmm. I worked in North America in different states. You have to understand that in those societies, it's very common for...
normal stuff.
For people to transition from their own home to a nursing facility. As they get older, as their chronic illnesses get worse, they're less independent, there are a lot of assisted facilities where elderly people live.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're in a facility and you're the manager, right, you have 100 people under you and a medical emergency happens, you need to make a decision as to what are you going to do. And advanced directives are very necessary when you have a situation where, you know, it's when I was in my fellowship, from the moment a person came to hospital from a nursing facility, we would ask, where is the advanced directive and what does it say?
Because it's not built into the system.
It's built into the system. And it immediately lets you know this person is a DNR.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to assess. We're going to see if there's anything reversible that we can treat, such as a urinary tract infection, a pneumonia. But it clearly states from this document that we are not doing CPR and we're not intubating. And it makes it very, it's very necessary to prevent less management of resources, for lack of, you know, in a better word.
Yeah.
Now, in the Bahamas, we're going to talk about where we are. Our history in terms of medical management comes from a Power of Attorney Act in 1992. Mm-hmm. Now, the Power of Attorney Act is something that has a legal background to say that even while you're alive and you want someone to make decisions for you in terms of your business, your banking, finances, you will do that. That usually ended after a person had a change in their mental status or was mentally incapacitated. And it's evolved to become the enduring power of attorney.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a document that can be made so that you can designate, again, who is the person who is going to make decisions upon my behalf if I'm unable to do so.
Right.
Enduring power of attorney documents can be tailored. They can be tailored to include decisions on medical care.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and that's something that people can consider to talk about. In the Bahamas, we are still very much a society, a community where people coming to hospital come with their relatives. They come with their loved ones. And, you know, if you are unable to make a decision for yourself, it's very easy to identify who that person is. Now, again, you talked about, you know, what if you're a person with 10 children and you have 10 different opinions?
Mm-hmm.
That's where the complications can come in when you have differing opinions within a family about a person. So there are some things that we can talk about and how to navigate that space. Mm-hmm.
I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices. We're going to take a quick break for some words from our sponsors and we'll be right back.
Ladies, at Oak Tree Medical Center, your health is our priority. From early detection to advanced treatment options, our comprehensive breast care services are here to support you every step of the way. With locations at East Street South, Prince Charles Drive, and our state-of-the-art surgical suites and MRI, top of the hill Mackey Street, we're right where you need us. Because when it comes to your breast care, you deserve the best care. And remember, the Million Mammogram movement continues. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com to learn more. Oak Tree Medical Center, caring, compassionate, complete.
Discover the ultimate in personalized healthcare with the Oak Tree Primary Plus program. Enjoy comprehensive primary care, annual physicals, lab and imaging discounts, mental health screenings, and more, all tailored to meet your health needs. With flexible payment options, exceptional care has never been more accessible. Join today and take control of your health journey. Call 816-4-OPP, that's 816-4677, or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Primary Plus. Are you down with OPP? Gentlemen, it's time to take charge of your health with Oak Tree Medical Center. We provide comprehensive prostate care at affordable prices, from prostate-specific antigen tests to prostate ultrasounds to advanced prostate MRIs. We've got you covered. Need further evaluation or treatment? Oak Tree Surgical Suites offers biopsies and in-house surgery. Our team of experts is here for you every step of the way. Visit us at Oak Tree Medical Center on East Street South and Prince Charles Drive, or for surgical procedures, find us at Oak Tree Surgical Suites, top of the hill, Mackey Street. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Medical Center. Caring, compassionate, complete. Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation.
Yeah, because that's the thing. So I think there's so much culture. I think that's the thing. I think one of the easiest and obvious answers here is the cultural issue. So there are different elements of what our culture looks like that makes it difficult, right? So you will have, I think the general idea that people have is, you know, well, we sticking this out to the end, right? And you have that component of it. You also have a lot of broken home situations. And so now it's the legal matter of, well, who actually has the right to have input, who doesn't have the right to have input, and all of these things kind of complicate it. And then, you know, we are religious people, and we want to believe that there's something, that miracles can happen right up to the end. And so even that, all of that kind of, I think, is the soup that we walk into that kind of makes it difficult for people to navigate these situations, or it gives us a very particular viewpoint on how we navigate. And then, like you said, when you consider that the legal framework isn't quite as mature here with regards to this particular issue, then it's not even this commonplace conversation. And that's why I think a conversation like this one is important.
Absolutely.
So people can kind of understand this is something that exists. This is something that you should be going to put into place. And it can help you, because I think what it does take off the table is some of the tension in the conversations in the moment. Because if mommy or daddy or grammy already has something written out, and this was done when they were in sound mind and all of those things, then it's kind of like, okay, we're abiding by our loved one's wishes. And it doesn't get to be, well, I'm upset with this one because they did this and I don't want them involved. All of those sorts of elements get pulled off of the table. And I think that speaks to the importance of the advance directives in the first place, right?
Right. Exactly. I think you summed it up. And I think there's a couple of things I would like us to walk through in
sure.
terms of talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Correct, right? So you mentioned the spiritual aspects. You mentioned, you know, end-of-life decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the challenges we face, you know, coming in, I find patients come into the ICU acutely,
mm-hmm.
And everyone says...
Explain acutely.
Well, they come to the ICU with an illness that seems acute,
mm-hmm.
seems new.
Right, something that just happened.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and it hasn't just happened. It's actually been going on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And in some people's mind, it's like, okay... Well, they were fine, and now we're here.
Right. Like, what is happening? How did
right?
how did this escalate to this degree so quickly?
And it's because we're not great patients. We don't get our
horrible.
Checkups. We don't comply with medication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes we're not following the advice that we've been given. You have the religious component where we're not claiming it.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things come into play. When a person
compliance issues
comes into the ER, ends up in the ICU, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, we talked about how coming to the ICU is usually the worst day of your life.
Mm-hmm.
We're not planners. We don't like to prepare. We're in denial that we're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have our business affairs and everything ordered up to plan for this day. And I think this conversation should prompt conversations in families,
mm-hmm.
in people's minds to say, what's going to happen on that day when I'm not here?
Right.
What's going to happen on that day right before I'm not here?
Mm-hmm.
What do I want to make sure that I have in place, like you say, so that what I want happens, so that there's less conflict? If you know, there's conflict in your home, you
mm-hmm.
do need to start to set, delegate and say, this is the person I would like to make decisions for me. This
mm-hmm.
is, you know, this is the person I believe will be able to handle
the weight
of making a decision.
Yeah.
I'm not going to force people to have to make that decision and have that conversation and go back and forth. I want to try to avoid that
mm-hmm. as far as possible.
And I want to be real. I want to be realistic about what my situation is and what I can expect if I come to the ICU.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of patients who come to the ICU with an acute illness who make a good recovery. They go back home, back to their baseline functional level.
And everything's fine.
There are other patients who have been chronically ill, who this ICU admission is like the final nail. You're not able to recover to your baseline. You
mm-hmm.
now become more dependent than you were before, which causes a whole change and shift in your dynamic at home
mm-hmm.
and your whole status. You talked about what happens if you don't have an advance directive. So when you walk into the ICU or the hospital, you sign consent forms to be treated. Mm-hmm. And medical decision making is based on informed consent, which mm-hmm. means that based on a universal human right, every person has the right to decide to be treated or not be treated and refuse treatment.
Right.
Okay. So when you come into the hospital and I say, hi, I'm Dr. Thompson, I'm going to be your doctor today. Mm-hmm. This is what's going on with you. This is what I feel should be done. Informed consent means that I provide you information about the treatment, giving you the risk, the benefits, mm-hmm. the alternatives to my suggested treatment, the risk and the benefits of those alternatives, mm-hmm. and what could possibly happen if you completely refuse treatment.
Altogether.
Right. Okay? So, you know, that's a conversation that is had with every patient, in addition to family members. Mm-hmm. Now, things can change. And the problem is a patient comes into the hospital, is able to consent for themselves, and during that admission, they do not, they're suddenly not able. And I think it's very important, especially when I meet a patient, I ask, who's your next of kin? Mm-hmm. You have that conversation upright mm-hmm. when they're able to tell you, this is the person who's mm-hmm. going to sign on my behalf. You know, because we do so many procedures that always require a signature. It means that you were told what was going to happen,
right.
what to expect, what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And so you understand that. We are very much in an era of full 100% information, full disclosure, mm-hmm. I think is the right word I'm trying to use.
Right.
Which may be a shift where, you know, patients just said, do whatever, do what you need to do.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm not sure if it's going to lead to better outcomes, but in terms of expectation and in terms of satisfaction, mm-hmm. having that information upfront is very important.
Okay. So what happens when a patient doesn't have an advance directive and the family is unsure or in conflict about next steps?
Good question. So most patients are not going to have an advance directive.
Right.
Okay. So again, patients and their family have the right to either accept or refuse treatment. Mm-hmm. The question is sometimes, do patients have the right to demand treatment? So that's I've read on the internet that this is what needs to happen and this is what you should do and this and that. And it's a very gray area, mm-hmm. but the most consensus is that, you know, as your physician, after reviewing the information about you, you know, we do not allow patients to demand treatment because we need to make sure that the treatment is appropriate to right. you. So in cases mm-hmm. of severe conflict or disagreements, mm-hmm. There is a mechanism in place in the hospital where cases can be referred to an ethics committee. Mm-hmm. And this ethics committee tries to assemble a group of persons who are not biased, mm-hmm. who have no direct connection, no thing mm-hmm. to gain. And you're presenting the information to say, this is a situation. We try to do standard of care, which right. means that we're applying the same treatment to a patient regardless mm-hmm. of whatever circumstances. Mm-hmm. And based on evidence, experience, this is the outcome that we would expect and this is the outcome we would not expect. Mm-hmm. And our goal is always as physicians is to do no harm.
Right.
And we would not want to do a procedure, give medications, or do anything that we feel is going to be harmful to a patient. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, again, you have emotions and just denial and guilt. And people say, you know, I want it all. Mm-hmm. And you might want it all, but that doesn't mean it's actually going to get you the result you think.
Right. And then sometimes people aren't really aware of what all is. And I think we'll get to that in a second. You know, can you share, I guess, a real life example where having or not having an advance directive made a major difference in a patient that you were dealing with?
So yes, in my training abroad, I would definitely say, you know, there was a case where we started treating a patient and the advance directive was not immediately available. Mm-hmm. But because mm-hmm. of the dire circumstances, we initiated care and treatment. And as soon as that advance directive was brought to light, mm-hmm. we followed the instructions
right.
and made adjustments.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, we do believe in respecting and honoring patients' rights. Mm-hmm. So there have been times previously, you know, in the United States where it has to be followed because mm-hmm. then you can be culpable for harming the patient.
Right.
If you are doing something that they have previously stated they didn't want to be done,
Because essentially you're doing something that's against their will.
Correct.
Yeah. And that's the whole point of the advance directive in the first place is for people to, well, I think that's a part of it too, right? Like we don't like to think about death.
We don't.
You know, you mentioned earlier that death is a part of life, but at the same time, and I think this is especially culturally true for Bahamians, and I think for Caribbean people in general, we do not like to think about death. And so therefore, the concept of sitting down and thinking, what would I want to do if I was in the process of dying? How would I want to be treated? How would I want... That's not a conversation that I think a lot of people are interested or willing to have.
It's not comfortable. It's uncomfortable.
It's very much. Mm-hmm.
We don't like to think about it. We want to be immortal. Right. We want to be here forever.
Mm-hmm.
That's not reality.
Right.
That's not reality. And I've been treating dying patients for many, many years. So I have experience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to say I'm comfortable with dying, but it doesn't frighten me.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, sometimes it happens tragically.
Mm-hmm.
It happens, you know, when it's unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that can be very heartbreaking because, you know, we go about our lives with plans and hopes.
Mm-hmm.
And death sometimes interrupts those plans and hopes that we have, you know. But sometimes death can be a very peaceful thing for someone who has been suffering in pain, living a life that is completely different from mm-hmm. they did previously, not enjoying the things they enjoyed,
right.
doing and participating in the activities they did. I definitely feel like today I want people to say, what's going to happen when I die?
Mm-hmm.
Answer that question, like, you know, brainstorm it
right.
so that you get a little bit more comfortable preparing for it.
Mm-hmm.
And preparation is key. Sometimes it helps you to manage crises better.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've at least thought about it and talked about it.
Yeah.
And then some things that you need to put in place,
mm-hmm.
maybe better put in place.
Yeah, because that's the thing. You have the opportunity to kind of, so like even if you have difficulty expressing yourself with people, if you have difficulty having like conflict and crisis type conversations, doing it outside of the existence of the actual crisis might make it easier to navigate and manage.
It does. When you're in the height of a situation, your emotions overwhelm you.
Mm-hmm.
Logic becomes...
obsolete. It goes out the window.
Non-existent. And so, obviously, that might lead you to make decisions that you would not have made otherwise. So, it's very important. We talk about what would you say to a patient who might want to prepare for a crisis?
I guess when a patient comes into hospital or... when a patient, maybe if they get a terminal diagnosis, what forms, tools exist to help people understand either as a patient what kind of information they can provide or for the loved ones to understand, you know, that these things exist? Like, is there material that exists to kind of help people navigate this process of understanding what the advanced directives are, being able to prepare and create, you know, and write down what their advanced directives are, and then... you know, maybe share it with particular family members so that there's at least someone who's understanding and aware before they get into a hospital critical situation.
I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not...
Fair enough.
...going to give legal advice. Because
it is a legal space.
It's a legal space.
It's a part of it.
So I would like to just raise awareness
mm-hmm.
that there is a way, if you wanted to completely document this in mm-hmm. a way that would be respected in a court of law
mm-hmm.
by the hospital, there is a document, the enduring power of attorney,
right.
that you can seek legal advice.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that there are definite patients, our Jehovah's Witness community, there are patients who do not accept blood products
right.
or transfusions. Mm-hmm. And I've definitely seen documents that have been prepared through the church
mm-hmm.
that patients bring to hospital mm-hmm. to specifically say, I do not want this. I mm-hmm. do not want this. I will accept this,
mm-hmm.
right? And one of the documents also talked about, like, in the case of an emergency, I want to be fully resuscitated.
Right.
So based on, you know, that community and their religious preferences,
mm-hmm.
they have created a tool that's the only time I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure I think it's a great idea, right? It's a right. great idea. And it's a little paper that is in the wallet
mm-hmm.
that they walk around with. So mm-hmm. obviously in an emergency, you present to hospital.
You have the documentation that indicates that.
And you know that that decision was made in a non-crisis state,
right.
was thought through,
mm-hmm.
and that's, again, something that would be respected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is interesting because you do have things like that do inform how people think about it and what their decisions would be and how they would want to be managed. This next question, I think, is an important one because I think it goes back to a part of our conversation from earlier when you talk about... you know, the DNR part of it, I didn't really understand. You know, again, you come from a layman's perspective, like you watch medical shows, you see, oh, we're doing CPR. So you see, you know, they're doing the chest compressions and things like that. It was news to me. The first time my wife was like, well, you know, when you go into doing CPR, there's a chance that you could like crack a rib and things like that. And so, you know, going back to, I think you were mentioning about people are not necessarily aware of the potential ramifications of going through the CPR process. So what does resuscitation include? So if someone comes in and they don't have a DNR and so you're going through that process, what does that look like and what potential impact could it have on the patient?
Great question. So resuscitation means to bring back, right? Mm-hmm. So you've walked in, you have no pulses, you're not breathing. Mm-hmm. We start CPR, that's a whole protocol we call the Advanced Cardiac Life Support Protocol, mm-hmm. right? So CPR, it's medications, epinephrine, it's fluids, it's oxygen. It can potentially include intubating mm-hmm. a person, putting a breathing tube in your mouth mm-hmm. so we can supplement and deliver oxygen to you. Sometimes resuscitation is not in an emergency state. You haven't lost your pulse. Sometimes right. it's IV fluids. Mm-hmm. You're dehydrated. Sometimes it's just supplemental oxygen because mm-hmm. you're short of breath. So resuscitation can vary. The most advanced form of resuscitation now is commonly called ECPR, which mm-hmm. includes ECMO, which is an extracorporeal membrane oxygenation. And basically that involves placing cannulas into your vessels mm-hmm. and you go onto a machine right away that supports both your lungs and your heart. There's a very iconic picture in the Louvre in Paris because mm-hmm. Paris has made a decision they're going to be the ultimate resuscitators, and a patient collapsed in the Louvre Museum mm-hmm. and they called 911 and an ECMO team. There's a mobile ECMO team that arrives on site and cannulates you, puts you on the machine, and gives you that support, mm-hmm. gets you to hospital, and then figures out, you know, why did you
die? In the moment.
And even in, you know, that is like the future mm-hmm. of mobile ECMO teams mm-hmm. responding to crisis outside of the hospital and even inside the hospital. Mm-hmm. So that's resuscitation, bringing you back. Again, does it work? Is it necessary? It's very traumatic. Mm-hmm. You can break ribs. You can get lots of damage from internal bleeding, mm-hmm. possibly. And so it depends. Is it suitable for every patient?
Right.
Again, every patient is assessed individually. Sometimes we know it's not going to be successful. Mm-hmm. If your disease is to a point where you've exhausted your reserves.
Right.
In the hospital, I've seen patients with metastatic cancer. Mm-hmm. You know, the question is, should they be full COVID? You know, mm-hmm. in the case of cardiac arrest, should we intubate them? You know, if you have disease in your lungs, in less than 10% of your lungs are healthy to start with, is it likely that intubating you and putting you on a ventilator is going to reverse your illness and right. get you back to your baseline, get you home? Mm-hmm. And so I like to be very careful about how you consider this and present this, because mm-hmm. sometimes people feel like making you DNR is giving up on you. Mm-hmm. It means that, you know, something happens, I'm not going to blink, I'm not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case. Right. DNR is not do not treat.
Right.
So.
Right. Because that's an important distinction.
That's very important distinction. It doesn't mean that if you're dehydrated, if you're in pain, mm-hmm. if you need oxygen, we're going to ignore you.
Right.
But it does mean that we're balancing the risk, mm-hmm. the dangers from the resuscitation with the outcomes.
Right.
You know, again, case by case basis. Mm-hmm. But mentally, you know, people, I want to break down that stigma that DNR means that we're just gonna let you die.
Right.
You know, if you go into cardiac arrest and you're about to die, you know, that might be a very, you know, better option mm-hmm. than constantly living in pain, mm-hmm. not being able to communicate, mm-hmm. not being independent.
Yeah.
Something to think about, right?
Mm-hmm. So you think about if Grammy is sitting up there and she's 85 years old and it's something that's terminal, and is, because obviously the older you are, the more likely it is that you may have a bone break and things like that. And so it really is that understanding of what you're considering when you go through the process of making the decision, and not just simply jumping to, like you said, because I think that's a very important thing to explain to people, which you did, which is DNR does not mean do not treat.
Correct.
Right. So if they are on pain medications will continue. If they are on whatever else, like that'll continue. What it simply means is in this specific instance, if this cardiac arrest event were to happen, we will not go through the process of resuscitation.
Correct.
Now, if the patient just happens to bounce back naturally in that space,
absolutely,
that's an entirely different thing.
Absolutely.
Right. And I think that is very important for people to understand the difference. I think it might be that. I think a lot of people may go to this concept of that means you're not going to treat Grammy at all.
Walk away.
Right. And no. And I think it's important that people recognize that that's not what that means.
And I also wanted to say the impact on the patient surviving resuscitation, surviving mm-hmm. a cardiac arrest. You know, we talked about your otherwise healthy patient who can come to ICU, get treated with antibiotics, maybe vasopressors. There are a lot of patients who come to ICU and are not the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There are definitely reports that an ICU experience, people have hallucinations, they end up with mental challenges, anxiety, depressions, mm-hmm. post-traumatic stress disorder. A lot of times you're in the ICU and for your patient's safety, because you're in an altered mental state, your hands are tied, you okay. know, and that's for safety reasons.
Right.
But there are reports that, you know, after you leave ICU, that had a major impact. You don't go back to the same level of cognition.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go back to the same level of mobility and independence. And so it has to be anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be considered
mm-hmm.
when you say, yes, I'm going to do all of this. I'm going to do everything because you're trying to resuscitate. But does that mean that you actually get back to your baseline? And there's no predicting who that will happen to and mm-hmm. when that will happen. You know, our goal is to try to give patients the best care possible, but we have to understand all of these things are, you know, come into play when we resuscitate, when the patients come through an ICU and have that experience.
Mm-hmm. I hope you're enjoying this episode of Vital Voices. We're going to take a quick break for some words from our sponsors and we'll be right back.
Ladies, at Oak Tree Medical Center, your health is our priority. From early detection to advanced treatment options, our comprehensive breast care services are here to support you every step of the way. With locations at East Street South, Prince Charles Drive, and our state-of-the-art surgical suites and MRI, top of the hill Mackey Street, we're right where you need us. Because when it comes to your breast care, you deserve the best care. And remember, the Million Mammogram movement continues. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com to learn more. Oak Tree Medical Center, caring, compassionate, complete.
Discover the ultimate in personalized healthcare with the Oak Tree Primary Plus program. Enjoy comprehensive primary care, annual physicals, lab and imaging discounts, mental health screenings, and more, all tailored to meet your health needs. With flexible payment options, exceptional care has never been more accessible. Join today and take control of your health journey. Call 816-4-OPP, that's 816-4677, or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Primary Plus. Are you down with OPP? Gentlemen, it's time to take charge of your health with Oak Tree Medical Center. We provide comprehensive prostate care at affordable prices, from prostate-specific antigen tests to prostate ultrasounds to advanced prostate MRIs. We've got you covered. Need further evaluation or treatment? Oak Tree Surgical Suites offers biopsies and in-house surgery. Our team of experts is here for you every step of the way. Visit us at Oak Tree Medical Center on East Street South and Prince Charles Drive, or for surgical procedures, find us at Oak Tree Surgical Suites, top of the hill, Mackey Street. Call us today at 322-1145 or visit oaktreemedicalcenter.com. Oak Tree Medical Center, caring, compassionate, complete. Welcome back to Vital Voices. Let's continue our conversation.
We're going to jump ahead a little bit. What would you say is the emotional toll on families who are unprepared compared to those who at least have had the conversation beforehand?
So it's really hard. It's really hard. Basically, there's always this shock,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you have the grief process,
mm-hmm.
right? It's the denial, it's mm-hmm. the anger, mm-hmm. it's the bargaining, then the acceptance, you know, and it's very hard, like I say, to prepare. Yes, it's very challenging to help patients and their family members through the emotions of an ICU admission. I think providing emotional and spiritual support is very important.
Mm-hmm.
There have been times recently when a patient was brain dead, it was obvious that they were going to expire.
Mm-hmm.
I encourage the family members to call their pastor, mm-hmm. their priest, to get them involved so that they can have prayers done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certain things that people like to happen
mm-hmm.
before a loved one passes away. And again, I think another challenging aspect that family members can face is just information and sharing information. And sometimes they don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They want to keep everything private.
Yeah.
You know, worried about, oh, with this person, all sorts of reactions.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to meet patients where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when I'm giving information, I can't give everything all at once. I have to do it in stages. I try to say, the bottom line I would always like to say is, this patient is very sick.
Mm-hmm.
And they may not make it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like your mind needs time to prepare and adapt
and adjust that
to what is eventually about to happen.
Mm-hmm. I think we've talked about one or two of the misconceptions that exist in this space when it comes to advanced directives. And I'll bundle this with another question as well. So, you know, are advanced directives only for elderly patients? Are they only for terminally ill patients? Because I know that's one of the misconceptions that comes up. Like how early is too early?
Interesting question. I mean, I would say I don't think that it's only for elderly patients.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there are young patients with chronic illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the moment you have entered a space where you're on medications, you're seeing a doctor regularly,
mm-hmm.
you've been warned that there could be, you know, further progression of this illness, I think that is a time when you would start to want to consider exactly how much or how far or what you would like to have done so that everyone around you who
mm-hmm.
loves you, who supports you, knows what to do.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's being able to have the information. I think that's the most critical part, is having as much information to manage the process as early on. I mean, would you recommend somebody who's just happy and healthy and bouncing around, you know, some 40-year-old, 50-year-old who doesn't have any sort of health indications whatsoever? Because, like, would that be the time when there's actually no crisis to even consider? Is that a better time to do an advanced directive?
I'm not sure I would put a time on it again.
Fair enough.
I think, I don't know if you're asking me, you know, what does everybody want? What do you want? I can't imagine an otherwise healthy person full of life, full of happiness, I can't imagine you, but I can't imagine you saying, in the event of an emergency, do not resuscitate me.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's too far out of any form of thinking in that moment, I guess.
But I don't think it's necessary.
Right.
I feel like, you know, every person deserves, I believe, most
mm-hmm.
patients deserve a fighting chance.
Right.
You know, in the event where you say that this is going to cause maybe too much financial distress on my family,
mm-hmm.
you might be confident enough to say, no, I do not want to be admitted to hospital, to the ICU, and have all of these things done. And
Can go that far.
Well,
to say that you don't want to go to the ICU.
I mean, if you're talking about advanced directives,
right.
technically, you know,
it can go that far.
It can go that far.
That's true.
But I don't think there's any reason and that's why we want to talk about the role of primary care doctors
mm-hmm.
or specialists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like every patient should have a conversation with their doctor. Like, what do you think? Do you think there would be an appropriate level of care?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think would have happened? What do you think I should expect? Or do you think that now is the point where I make that declaration?
Right.
So that my family knows, like, I'm okay, you know. We've tried, we've been battling this back and forth. I've had enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think every person deserves that right to
right.
decide when enough is enough.
Do you think then that the physician is the best place to start that conversation? Like, if someone was considering advanced directives, like, is that a space where they start that conversation
Absolutely.
With their primary care physician?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, your primary care physician specifically knows you.
Well, that's right.
And your state of health.
History,
they
right?
know your background.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the non-crisis state,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm hoping this conversation helps people to be more proactive about their health,
mm-hmm.
know your numbers, know
mm-hmm.
your heart rate, know your blood pressure, know your A1C level, know your cholesterol, know your numbers, mm-hmm. and do better.
Yeah.
Because surviving in the ICU, definitely, if you're controlled, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of your chronic illnesses, you have a much better chance of surviving ICU compared right. to if you're uncontrolled.
Mm-hmm. That's it. And that's it. In a family medicine physician coming out.
Yes.
You know, for our listeners, whether they're patients or caregivers, physicians, other people within the healthcare industry, what are the first steps that they can take today in terms of either if it's getting better understanding, if it's starting the process, what does someone do next with this information?
I would say, you know, have a discussion mm-hmm. with the people who are important to you. Mm-hmm. Start that discussion today and then speak to your doctor, speak to your health provider. And have a discussion about how you can optimize your health or mm-hmm. how you can go about making the steps necessary mm-hmm. to plan and put formally in place what you would want.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. What's the one thing you wish every family knew before they faced a medical crisis?
It's going to happen. I want every family to know it's going to happen. Like, this is life. Mm-hmm. This is life. Things happen. And again, if you know, if you prepare for mm-hmm. a crisis, you are better able to weather the storm of the crisis.
Right. I think in a lot of ways, the same way that we'd like to think that we're immortal is the same way that we'd like to think that everybody's just going to, you know, go to sleep one night and just not wake up and it not be a crisis and it not be
That might be beautiful and peaceful. Yeah, right. right?
But it's not everyone's story. There are going to be people who have that experience, but by and large, like you said, it's going to happen, even if it's not to you directly. It'll be a family member, and you still want to know how to navigate and manage that. So be prepared.
Be prepared.
You know, I think one of the things that advanced directives bring about, and I think you mentioned this in our conversation, is the concept of empowered care. So, you know, what does that mean to you as we wrap up?
I feel empowered care is a reflection of shared decision making. Mm-hmm. To me, that's a collaborative process that allows patients or their surrogates and clinicians to make healthcare decisions together. Mm-hmm. Now, we have to take into account, you know, the health literacy, what your exposure is, what your experience is, what your right. level of knowledge is. And it's really a combination of what I know, what my experience is, mm-hmm. what my assessment is based on this particular patient, mm-hmm. and what you expect or know or understand. And I feel like making sure at every opportunity patients understand why we're doing things, mm-hmm. what is the next best steps, you know, what to expect, mm-hmm. I think that's empowered care.
Okay. This has been an awesome and amazing conversation. Can you let people know how they can get in contact with you if they want to learn more or, you know, do you see patients like that? Wait, do people book visits with you? No way.
In the ICU?
No. No, because you're not in the ICU, but...
But I have an anesthesiologist. Right. Okay. So, and I also have a pain management clinic.
So let me rewind and then ask the question.
Okay.
So in your role, obviously, you're an anesthesiologist. You are a critical care intensivist. You also operate in the pain management space. So, you know, we didn't quite touch on all of that, but obviously... You are a well-versed physician with a number of different ways that you practice medicine. If someone wanted to get in contact with you to learn more about that, if they needed to book you for an anesthesia visit, if they have need of pain management services, how would they get in contact with you?
I work at Doctors Hospital. I'm in a specialty clinic. You can call for an appointment at 302-4600. I can also be reached at email, thoja@doctorshosp.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, taking time out of your busy schedule. This is an amazing conversation. I'm sure it's going to be helpful for people because this is an area where I think there's a lack of understanding and education culturally for us. So I'm hoping that, you know, a lot of people get a chance to listen and understand a bit better how to navigate through this process.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Awesome. What an insightful conversation. A special thank you to Dr. Jazreel Thompson for pulling back the curtain on life-saving world of critical care and for reminding us that planning ahead isn't just wise, it's empowering. If today's episode moves you, share it with someone you love, start the conversation, have the talk, and most of all, take that first step towards creating an advanced directive. It might just be the most important gift you can give your family. For more meaningful conversations on health and healing, subscribe to Vital Voices wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, stay informed, stay empowered, and be well.
Did you miss a part of today's show?
You can catch this episode and all Vital Voices episodes online at youtube.com/@VitalVoices242. See you next week as we sit down with another Vital Voice.
We'd like to give a special thank you to today's sponsor, Oak Tree Medical Center.